Monday, December 6th, 2404, 11:31 a.m., Yedor, Minbar. Mia adjusted the cuffs of her best robe's sleeves again, though there was nothing wrong with them, and patted at her thick, wavy black hair, though no one else on Minbar would ever know if it looked right or not anyway. She knew they were just nervous habits, but they were better than pacing, so she didn't try to stop herself. Her uncle Devon, tall, slender, spiky-crested, smiled at her from the bench along the anteroom's wall. He looked calm enough to make Mia want to hate him, just for a moment. She could never, of course. He was her only blood relative who would speak to her, after all, except for her father, who wasn't allowed to see her. "Be calm, Mia," he told her, in his soft, smooth voice. "It's only a formality." Mia nodded. "I know, Uncle," she said. "Still, the Grey Council." Devon smiled a little wider, but before he could speak, the door before them opened silently onto darkness. "Go," said Devon softly. "Your mother will be watching you. Speak from your heart." Mia nodded again, then turned, squared herself up, and went through the doors. There was a single spot of light shining on the bare floor. In the darkness, it was impossible to tell anything about the room, not even its size. Something in the air gave it an unconscious sense of vastness, though. Vastness and immense age. Mia walked into the spot of light and stopped, her eyes searching the blackness around her. Then, without warning, there they were, standing in a circle around her, each illuminated by his own similar light from the invisible ceiling. They wore identical gray robes, and their faces were downturned, hidden in the shadows of their hoods. Mia looked from one to the next, but it was impossible to tell which of them was the only friend she might expect to have in this room. There was one who definitely wasn't, though. The tall, broad-shouldered one who bore the staff of the council's leader. Mia knew him on sight, identified him by his size and by his staff, though she could not see his face. Her uncle had often spoken of him, for he held the highest position in Devon's caste, the warriors. Nerun, the leader of the Grey Council, spoke the ceremonial words that opened any and every gathering of that council, describing its foundation by Valen himself, its composition, its purpose, in language ancient and elegant. Then he reached up, pushed back his hood, and turned his cold, patrician face and sharp, perceptive eyes on Mia. "Mia, child of Lemia, late of the House of Ausa," he said. "You have a petition you wish this council to hear?" Mia forced her voice not to quaver as she nodded her head respectfully and said, "I do." "Then speak," said Nerun, in a tone which came just politely short of implying that she was wasting his very valuable time. "As the council no doubt knows," said Mia carefully, "I have just passed the 14th anniversary of my birth on the old calendar. I feel that the time is right for me to claim the name of my mother's house and decide the course of my future." Nerun looked first to one side of Mia, then the other, managing to pass his eyes over her in the process without giving the impression he had actually seen her, and nodded. "The name is yours by birthright," he said. In his voice was an undercurrent of reluctance which Mia did not fail to pick up. "And what of your future, Mia of Ausa?" he went on, sounding faintly mocking. Mia felt herself tremble inside, quashed it fiercely. She wouldn't let him get her down, make her embarrass herself in front of the council. Of course he had nothing but disdain for her. It was Nerun who had called her the shame of all Minbar at her birth, her impossible birth, the child of a Minbari woman and the Earthman she had loved illegally, never dreaming that a child could result. That complacency had cost Lamia of Ausa her position as assistant to a Satai, her standing in society, the regard of all but one of her relatives, and, in the end, her life. And Nerun, Mia knew. Nerun had stood over her deathbed, and declared her fate justice for the disgrace she had brought to Minbar. All that, knowledge no one else in the world knew she had gathered, knowledge her beloved uncle had tried to protect her from and still believed that he had succeeded, flashed through her mind in an instant as Nerun's mocking tone bit into her. And for that instant, just an instant, she felt her fists clenching. It would be so easy to make Nerun pay for his arrogance, his bigotry, his callous dismissal of her mother's suffering and death as justice, his never-veiled contempt of her uncle Devon for the young warrior's belief in the ancient ways of the An-Lashak. Nerun never would have dreamed that her family's neglect could have had a positive outcome. But an intelligent, inquisitive girl, all but abandoned in the greatest storehouse of knowledge the modern universe boasted, could learn all manner of fascinating things. Mia caught herself in a nanosecond and forced herself back into the composure that she had never visibly lost. Never had the temptation to abuse what she had learned in the endless solitary hours in the library been so strong, and never had the responsibility that knowledge carried with it been more clearly etched on her soul. In that respect, then, this was a valuable experience, something, she thought with bitter humor, to thank Nerun for. "The calling of my heart is clear," said Mia, making herself meet his cold, uncaring eyes without flinching. "My path is my mother's. I seek admission to the religious caste, to devote my days to the study and the glory of the word of Valen." Nerun's mocking smile almost lost its veneer of cordial impartiality, and even as he spoke, Mia felt her heart sinking, knowing that the fix was in. "Mia, of the House of Ausa, has made clear her wishes. How speaks the Council?" All around Mia, one by one, the lights revealing the members of the Grey Council went out, until only one, aside from Nerun, remained. "Well," some part of Mia's mind said wryly while the rest of her raged in silence, "now you know which one is Delenn." "Unfortunately," said Nerun in a voice that left no doubt that he found it anything but, "there is no place for you among those of the religious caste at this time, Mia of Ausa. However," he went on charitably, "Valen teaches us that no Minbari shall lead a life without purpose. A place has been prepared for you in the caste of workers. You will report to the guild hall of the Sanitary Legion tomorrow and begin your training as a cleaner." He smiled benevolently. "Perhaps you will be placed in charge of maintaining the cleanliness of the library," he said, as if offering a condolence. He banged the end of his staff upon the stone floor, a clear dismissal, and waited for her to leave. But Mia Ausa did not leave. Instead, she stood looking at the floor for a moment, her lip trembling, willing herself not to break, not to give him the satisfaction. "The Council has made its decision plain," said Nerun in a warning voice. "All Minbari must abide by those decisions." He said it with that pause again, that poisonous pause which silently added, "and those nameless things that presume to call themselves Minbari, too." As the pause and the subvocal sneer came, something inside Mia did break. But it wasn't her heart, or the dam holding back her tears. Her shoulders stiffened, her hands at her sides flexing again. Then she raised her tearless eyes to Nerun's and said, "Then the Council leaves me no choice." "I am glad you see it that way," said Nerun mock pleasantly. But Mia wasn't done talking, and her voice, suddenly clear and hard, cut him off, echoing in the vastness of the chamber. "I had hoped I would not have to do this," she said. "Despite everything, I love Minbar, and had hoped for the chance to live out my days here, in study and contemplation of the truth of Valen. But Valen's law says that a Minbari's first obligation is to the calling of her heart, and my heart does not call me to the worker caste. It is a noble and honorable calling," she added for the benefit of the three workers who belonged to the council, who were still here, even if the snuffing of their lights in the vote had made them invisible. "But it is not mine. If this council cannot see fit to honor Valen's teachings and grant me the future on Minbar I choose, then I am forced to choose a future away from Minbar." Nerun actually looked taken aback. "Away from Minbar?" he said, his tone still mocking, but now puzzled atop that. Then, becoming indignant, he went on, "Nonsense. The council has spoken. Your place is prepared, Mia of Ausa, and you will not presume to educate the Grey Council as to the meaning of the word of Valen." "My father," Mia informed Nerun sharply, "as you and so many others never tire of holding over my head, is an Earthman. Under galactic law, I am therefore entitled to claim citizenship of the Earth Alliance as well. The petition, backed by a tie of blood, is automatic and cannot be denied." She took a deep breath, let it out, and said with much greater calm than she would have believed possible, "If this council insists on denying me the place my heart dictates for me on Minbar, then I hereby renounce Minbar. You have told me all my life that I am not Minbari. Fine, then, I am not. I am an Earthwoman, and as an Earthwoman I demand that the Minbari government grant me passage to my homeworld." She put an extra twist on the last word, digging it in, using it against Nerun and his supporters the way they had always used the word Earthman to hurt her, pretending they didn't know she could hear them. Nerun stared at her as though she'd suddenly grown a second head, all trace of his usual contemptuous cordiality wiped away for a moment by sheer surprise. Then he gathered himself in and sneered at her. "Out of the question. This foolishness will not reflect well upon you in the future, Mia." "You deny my right to Earth citizenship? You would disregard the international laws of the United Federation of Planets and cast a citizen of another sovereign nation into involuntary servitude?" Mia demanded, her voice thick with outrage, no longer contained. "You are many things, Setai Nerun, but I did not think you a common slave trader." Nerun's eyes widened with shock. The haughty warrior was struck absolutely speechless by that claim, leaving Mia an opening to continue in a more reasonable tone of voice. "However, there is an avenue open to us besides useless name-calling. I claim that I have certain rights under international law. You dispute that claim. Under the Pact Babylonica, which you yourself signed 2 years ago, there is a clear path to resolution of this disagreement. We must refer the matter to the International Police for arbitration." Mia saw Nerun's face freeze and knew she had him. She was right. A matter such as this was tailor-made for IPO arbitration. But to bring an international police arbiter here, to lay this whole sordid matter out in front of him, to admit on the public record before the eyes of the galactic press that such a case would draw, like flies to Minbar in the arbiter's wake. Slowly, stiffly, Nerun conceded defeat. "Very well," he said reluctantly. "You will collect your belongings and leave this world within 48 hours. But know this, Mia of Ausa. As an Earthwoman, you will not be welcome on Minbar ever again."
"I never have been," Mia replied coldly.
Without acknowledging her further, Nerun extinguished his light. Somehow, Mia could sense all around her the counselors leaving, though their movements were as silent as they were invisible. As she turned to go, Mia saw with surprise that one counselor yet remained. And as Mia faced her, Delenn of Mir reached up and pushed back her cowl, then gestured for Mia to walk with her. "Very few," said Delenn carefully as the two left the council chamber, "have ever spoken to Nerun in such a fashion." "Perhaps that is his problem," Mia replied. Delenn permitted herself a very small smile and said dryly, "Perhaps. In any event, I am sorry it's come to this, Mia. I, too, had hoped that you would be granted your request." "I never really expected I would," Mia told her. "I only hoped. But they forced my hand, and here I am. Or rather, here I go." Delenn nodded. "As it happens," she said, "I will be leaving Minbar myself before too much longer. I've been named ambassador to the Babylon station." She looked concerned and asked, "Do you know where you will go?" "Earth," said Mia, "as I said I would. My father can arrange citizenship for me, and after that, I imagine I'll have to go to school somewhere. There are some good schools on Earth. Dad will probably have some ideas." She shrugged, a human gesture she'd learned from her infrequent, surreptitious visits with her father. "I'll find a new path." Delenn smiled, more openly this time, and said, "I wish you good fortune and peace in your search for it. Be well until I see you again." "And you, Satai Delenn," said Mia, and they took their leave of each other. Mia wondered just when she would see Delenn again. She supposed that, if the elder woman were taking a position on Babylon 5, Mia could visit her there. The station would be a public port once it was operational, free for all to enter if they could afford passage. "Aunt Delenn." Mia called her aunt, but of course she wasn't. Mia's mother had been her assistant years ago, before the tragic love affair with John Trussell of Earth. Aside from Devon and his Anlashok peers, dismissed as crackpots and fools by almost everyone on Minbar, she was the one Minbari adult who liked Mia, and so Mia called her aunt, at least privately. It was Delenn who had used her influence to ensure that Mia got to know her father as she grew up, seeing him twice or three times a year in some neutral location, usually by a rendezvous of starships. And now she would be appearing in his life, unceremoniously, full-time. She wondered how he would take that, if he would welcome her or resent the intrusion into his routine. Then again, if she went to boarding school, that would be mitigated. They wouldn't have to learn how to live with each other at this late date. Perhaps that would be for the best. Nonetheless, it was with a nervous heart that she went to find where her uncle had wandered off to, and ask his help in arranging things. As Mia finished her tale, Belana sat on the couch and gazed at her wide-eyed, her face bearing a look of wonder. "Wow," said the half-Klingon in amazement. "A common slave trader. That'd be like me telling off Chancellor Krojar in front of the High Council. Except on Kronos, what you did would have gotten you killed." She grinned. "Good thing Minbari are a bunch of peace-loving wimps." Mia would have remonstrated with her, but the impish grin on Belana's face made it clear she was only joking. "Well," Mia said, "at the time it seemed like the right thing to do." "So that's why you went all house on Uncle Claivor," Belana mused. "You were just doing to him what you wanted to do to that Maroon guy." Mia laughed. "Nerun," she chuckled. Then, sobering, she said, "I don't want you to get the impression that Satai Nerun is an evil man. He isn't. He's just blinded by his prejudices. He has a cruel streak, but reserves it for those he views as enemies. Unfortunately, he hates my father, and so he considered me his enemy from birth." She sighed. "As a warrior and a leader, he's very well regarded. He would never have made that cowardly final attack your uncle tried." B'Elanna nodded. "Uncle Glaivor talks a good game," she said, "but deep down inside he's just a piece of..." "B'Elanna," said Mia with laughing admonition, and the two girls giggled for a few moments before B'Elanna became serious and said, "Listen, I never thanked you for what you did. I really think you saved my life. If I'd had to go home with him, try to fit back into the life he and Mother wanted for me, I'd never have made it, one way or another." Mia got up from her chair, crossed the room, and sat down on the couch, patting B'Elanna's hand. "You're welcome," she said. "Anyway," she added lightly, "there were at least a dozen other people in that room who would have done it if I hadn't. Utrinna was about ready to run him through right where he stood. He really shouldn't have called her a cupcake." B'Elanna snorted. "Yeah, I thought for sure he was going to get it right in the gut for that one. He would have if I'd have been her." Mia smiled, then glanced at her watch. "Well, you'd best run along. Your lesson with Professor Krog is in 5 minutes." B'Elanna looked at her own watch. "Oh yeah, thanks, Mia. He gets so grumpy when I'm late." She hopped up from the couch, gave her hostess a cheery farewell, and left. Mia sat on the couch for a few more minutes, then went to her bookshelf and drew out one of her ancient texts. It had been beyond thoughtful of Delenn to slip several of Mia's favorites, titles of which the great library had duplicates, of course, but still, into her luggage before the girl had left Minbar to begin her self-demanded exile. She put the book down on her desk, then switched on her data terminal, called Babylon 5, and made an appointment with an excruciatingly earnest young attaché named Lanier to dine with Ambassador Delenn on Friday evening. The resurgent summer hung on for 2 glorious weeks, and then tumbled almost overnight into fall, which was even more glorious. The snap in the air reminded Utrinna pleasantly of her visit to Asgard, where it always feels a bit like October when it's not doing its best impression of February. And the foliage along the Autobahn was magnificent. Classes went well, so did the business of the Duelist Society. After their experiences over the spring and summer, they'd started really living up to the wording of their charter, testing themselves and each other in a meeting of diverse styles of combat, learning from each other and drawing a collective strength from their diversity. In the second week of the term, while summer still clung, they acquired a new member, Beld Marmo, a student of the traditional Centauri sword-fighting form, which utilized short, broad swords, not unlike Amanda Dessler's Gamelon tail blade. Marmo's flamboyance on the dueling floor almost equaled that of Skaya, which made them very interesting to watch together. He declined the Society's offer of a place in the castle, though, preferring to move into room 218 in Hannibal Hamlin Hall across campus, where Jacron had eagerly, and Mac had indifferently, made room for a new roommate. Truth be told, Jacron was starting to get a bit fed up with Harcourt Mackenzie, not "one of us has to go" fed up, but "that guy's going to kill himself" fed up. By Jacron's lights, Mackenzie was working himself to death. Between his advanced studies, his weekend freelance pilot job, and all the time he had to spend working on the ancient excuse for a starship he plied that job with, Mac had taken up a new mantra, to which he clung with all the fervor of a Kalidorian: sleep is a luxury. By October, Jacron was considering the purchase of a large animal tranquilizer gun to rein in his overworking roommate. Bell just shrugged and said, "A man has to do what a man has to do, eh, Jacron?" Which wasn't a very helpful attitude at all, if you asked Jacron. Meanwhile, Kate pieced her orchestra back together. The influx of new students in the new freshman class, returning from the political exile of the previous C and D terms on Earth, and joining the school's other grades outright, balanced out the loss of the Earther students. By October, they were rehearsing a fall pops program, Kate's own Symphony No. 1, and some other works in progress by Kate and Miki with satisfactory progress, if not quite as much cohesion as she would have liked. She consoled herself with the knowledge that this would come in time. Clarissa Broadbank had slipped easily and smoothly into her sister's old role, taking command of the remnant of Liza's clique which hadn't remained behind on Earth with consummate ease, despite the fact that, as a freshman, she was younger than any of them. She'd revived The Beacon, the former WPI's alternative newspaper, and set its editorial policies contentiously against those of the DSM official student paper, the whimsically named Institute Intelligencer. She'd claimed her sister's place in the student council, which may or may not have been a legitimate thing to do, and made a pain of herself at its functions, reminding Utrina intensely of someone she had known in the past. She was, Utrina reflected, even the right age. But Nanami had had her moments. Sometimes she was smart, and sometimes she was funny. And there just wasn't anything clever or humorous about Clarissa Broadbank. Still, the middle Broadbank hadn't really done anything yet. She'd settled in and taken over most of her sister's old functions, but she hadn't taken any direct action against anyone yet. They all knew it was coming, but so far Clarissa seemed content to settle in, get her bearings, and wait. In fact, the duelists had already frustrated her in one way, before the promised new war even began. By the time Clarissa got around to joining the fencing club, her sister's most jealously guarded old preserve, it had already been invaded by duelists. As Juri Arisugawa and Miki Kaworu had assumed that club's presidency and vice presidency. That was all quite legitimate. The old club's vice president hadn't come to DSM, and Liza, as president, had left an eerily prophetic note indicating that, if she didn't return from her summer's adventure on time, she was to be replaced until she did return by Juri. As acting president, Juri could then appoint anyone she cared to have as the old VP's replacement. Clarissa could grit her teeth and try to oust the redhead at the next officer's elections in January, but there was little more she could do about that, for the time being. The only three blots on the vista of the school year, as A-term wound down into mid-October and the evening shadows lengthened, were the unencouraging lack of news about the spirit of the river, the ongoing troubles of the Art of Noise, and the sudden resignation of one of the history professors, which left a bit of a gap in the faculty at an unfortunately timed juncture a week before finals. Of the first, there wasn't much to tell. The joint IPO-Ishkarat investigation turned up little evidence, and all of it unencouraging. The discovered wreckage had been analyzed and found to account for about half of the Spirit of the River's mass, most of its hull plating and drive components. It seemed clear that the other half of the ship wouldn't have been going anyplace on its own with that kind of damage. So where was it? So far there were no leads, and there didn't look like being any terribly soon. Azalin continued in her funk for a week or so, but seemed to snap out of it after the Festival of the Falling Leaves, which she conducted as an overnight excursion deep into the thick forest at the feet of the Caucasus Mountains. With Miki, Dorothy, a curious Sionji and Wakaba, and Mia Ausa in attendance, it was the most populous Falling Leaves Azalin had ever conducted off Dantrov, and she seemed mightily pleased with the result when they all returned to school the following morning. Seeing how cheerful they all were when they got back, Utrina almost wished she'd gone with them, even if she didn't want to know the details. As for the second problem, the travails of the Art of Noise, that was a stickier tangle. The main problem, as Miki Kaworu saw it, was Miki Kaworu. He'd only taken up the guitar earlier in that same year, after coming to Midgard, and though he was a prodigy and had mastered the technical aspects of the instrument in fairly short order, he wasn't satisfied with his ability to play as part of an ensemble, especially a rock band. A pianist by training, he was accustomed to being a soloist or duet player. Even an orchestral pianist is essentially a soloist who happens to be playing at the same time as an orchestra. Playing guitar, especially rhythm guitar, in a rock band was a whole different experience, and as the term went on and rehearsals continued, Miki became more and more frustrated with what he felt was a serious deficiency in his ability to click with the rest of the group. Amanda Dessler, the previous rhythm guitarist of The Art of Noise, had honed her own abilities in that regard by playing rhythm to the lead guitar line of her beloved elder brother Garen in an impromptu band composed of the two siblings and their Dragonar bodyguards. She'd had years, and the powerful motivation of her sheer adoration of her brother, to perfect that craft, and perfect it she had. Amanda was now the Gamelon ambassador to nearby Babylon 5, and as such, she was local, even if she was too busy to remain in the band. She visited a couple of rehearsals, offered Miki a few tips and a generous helping of encouragement, but admitted when pressed to be blunt that no, he wasn't as good as she had been. She hastened to add that she thought his performance perfectly serviceable, though. Miki might have become less intense and neurotic since coming to this world, but he was still a perfectionist about his music, and perfectly serviceable wasn't damn well good enough. He felt he was dragging the band down, and was starting to consider suggesting to Kate that her band would be better served if she found someone else to take over, despite the insistence of everyone involved that things would be fine if he would just relax and let it come at its own pace. That problem, as it turned out, would be solved by the solution to the third problem. Monday, October 17th, 2405. Several of the duelists and their extended circle of friends, including Kate, all the Sephirians, Jacron, and Moose, were members of Mr. Kesselring's Galactic History 301 class, 10 a.m. every weekday but Wednesday in Parkinson 117, the new history building's big ground-floor lecture hall. All of them entered that hall wondering exactly what would await them on this, the last Monday before finals. They all liked Kesselring, a cheerful man with a comical German accent who claimed to be a descendant of the World War II general, and were sad that he'd had to go suddenly back to Niyogi to see to a family crisis. But more than that, they were wondering what was to become of their term's work so far. Could a reasonable replacement for a galactic history teacher be found on such short notice, so close to the end of the term in this still rather remote location? Would one of the other history professors have to take up the slack? How would that affect the program? They needn't have worried. As they and the 60 other students who made up the double-sized lecture class took their seats and arranged their notebooks, the doors down at the front of the lecture hall opened, and a woman entered, carrying a brown leather satchel. She was dressed in a green cable-knit sweater and woolen skirt, and had a great deal of long, golden-brown hair that was pulled back from her pretty oval face in a great thick braid, tied with a gold ribbon. She didn't look much more than 5 years or so older than the students in the class, and as she put her satchel down on the desk, opened it, and took out the teacher's edition of their textbook, half the boys and a couple of the girls in the class fell instantly and hopelessly in love with her. Utina and Caitlin, on the other hand, were just staring at her in dumbfounded amazement. "Good morning, class," said the substitute teacher in a voice that was at once soft and pleasant, but clearly audible everywhere in the room. She smiled benevolently at the class and said, "I'm Mrs. Morisato, and I'll be taking over for Mr. Kesselring starting today." Mrs. Morisato, better known to Kate and Utina as Aunt Bell, stopped by the castle in the early evening, just in time for dinner. She insisted on helping in the kitchen, and unlike Erd's well-meaning but inept efforts, her help actually helped. Bell had met many of the duelists the previous February, when she'd visited WPI to help Utina with a bit of a problem on the same day that Juri Arisugawa had arrived on campus. Those she didn't know were introduced, and any worries they might have had over being visited by a faculty member and relation of the president's were immediately put to rest by Bell's sweet and unassuming manner. After dinner, Moose McEachern arrived from Hamlin Hall, where he now shared a room again with his old WPI roommate, Davy Crockett, from Tankton. He carried with him his usual good cheer and his bass guitar, slung over his back in a gig bag. The castle's second floor contained a number of large rooms, though not as large as the main dueling room below. These had probably been used as exercise rooms and smaller dojos by the Jedi who built the place millennia ago. For this purpose, the duelists used them also, except for the one which had been staked out by the Art of Noise as their rehearsal room. Here, various members of the society tended to sit on one of a couple of old couches the WDF engineers had donated, and listen to the band rehearse. The couches had been put here for the benefit of the band, during breaks, but they also served to house the ever-fluctuating peanut gallery. Every duelist had, at some point or another, stopped by to watch their president and her band hone their craft. Utna rarely missed a rehearsal, and indeed she was there now, over in the corner, with her calc homework spread out on half of the couch, and a pen stuck behind her ear as she grappled with a particularly sticky integral. Idly, she scratched behind the ears of Dorothy's pet cat, Peril, while she worked. Normally, she'd have had Miki Kaworu to help her with the math, but he was up on the riser, trying once again to get it together with the band, so all she had for assistance was Tiny Robo, who could stand there on the arm of the couch looking impressive and supervising, but not offer much in the way of actual math help. Juri Arisugawa was there, too, sitting on the opposite end from Utena in her chaos of paperwork. She was supposed to be reading a novel for her advanced literature class, but she was spending more time looking at Caitlin. It wasn't that Kate was particularly dolled up. In fact, in old jeans and a sweatshirt, with her hair pulled back into a loose ponytail, she was looking decidedly casual. But she looked so pleased with things that Juri's eye kept being drawn back to her smile. One of the main reasons Kate was happy was at the soundboard, making the band's mix sound right for the first time since Miki gave up the board for the rhythm guitar. The board was an old one and a bit temperamental. If not constantly tended, it was prone to wander out of true. The fact that he was no longer tending it gave Miki another reason to feel like he was letting the band down, until Dorothy told him that if he didn't stop worrying about that, she would be forced to smack him. Besides, now Aunt Belle was on the scene, and she had a way of talking to the balky old board so that it gave its best effort. If Juri hadn't heard the previous version of the band at the absolute peak of its ability, she would never have thought there was anything amiss with the group as it currently stood. As it was, they still sounded good to her, as they attempted one of the old group's standards, the song with which they'd opened every show of theirs she'd attended. Midway through the song, they stopped. Miki, looking frustrated, sighed. "I think I've figured out what the problem is anyway," he said. "It's trying to take my lead from two different places at once." Moose nodded. "Taking your lead from Dorothy and me, and trying to counterpoint Azalin at the same time?" "Yeah, it's a lot tougher than Amanda made it look," said Miki, looking hangdog and sheepish. "I'm sorry, Caitlin. I don't think I'll be ready for a fall break show." Kate shrugged. "It's okay, Miki," she told him. Relax. "It takes most people years to get as good as you are. A lot never get that good." Miki nodded, but he still looked down as he said, "But still, maybe it would be best if I went back to the board and you found someone else?"
"At the risk of seeming snippy," said Moose, "which I certainly don't intend to be, where would you suggest we look?"
Beltandy slipped off her headphones and said, "Perhaps what you need is a teacher."